This is We Met You When, a podcast by journalism students at Toronto Metropolitan University. We go back in time, dig up news stories from 2013, and track down the people in those stories.
So that sound has always stuck with me. And it's one of those things that I'll continue to carry with me, not to get too dark and deep, but it's one of those things that I still can hear, even 10 years later.
We want to know, what happened after their names were in the news?
I sat down at the piano and I remember trying to play. And then after like 2 minutes, I just like broke down into tears because I felt like I had lost so much of my abilities, my technique, everything I had worked for.
Well, we have managed to fill in some of the gaps, but there are still many mysteries, and we're so pleased that the Allison project has lasted all these 10 years.
That really started my career in doing social work with people living with dementia.
Some were teens when they were interviewed, others were adults. No one was in a position of power. But many of them felt the power a new story can have.
And I'd say, unfortunately, probably for the first couple interviews after that I gave, I think I was higher in anxiety, just kind of anticipating like, oh no, what are they going to say? Like it, kind of maybe a little bit distrustful.
I connected with it on somewhat of a personal level. But I never thought that it would actually like get to this stage where it is now, and seeing that like evolution is really crazy.
Yes, that's my voice. As we've been exploring the difference a decade makes and the difference we journalists can make going forward by going back to 2013, my group landed on a story that surprisingly brought me closer to my family in Europe. I'm Matisse Sheik. You're listening to We Met You When, Season 2. This is Memories of Mammy. My family would visit this apartment in Paris occasionally. They usually didn't want the kids to go into the room. Sometimes I would play this game with myself to see if I could get to the room, down that long dark corridor. Throughout the entire corridor on the left, there's a continuous mirror. So you're kind of just walking whilst you're staring at yourself. And that used to scare me. Just the entire corridor leading up to this room. And the door would always be slightly ajar. It would never fully be opened. And coming out of that room, that tiny little space, you would see like this bright light. I remember it so well. So my brother and I would spend our time playing in my grandfather's office. He had a bunch of these statues and these boats and things that we play with and look at. I remember hearing sounds out of her door because she would sometimes yell and have these sounds that you would hear from afar. And I was maybe 4 or 5 at the time. So as a child, I knew that these were not normal sounds. So I was somewhat scared. I never really wanted to go into the room. But the woman inside that room wasn't scary to everyone. Actually, most of my family would say she was full of love.
When she was coming and picking me up at school, she would always come with an afternoon snack, so a little piece of baguette with a piece of chocolate inside. And we would walk together back home, so taking the metro together and then getting back home. It was a 30-minute commute every day. I was having all my lunches at her place. When I was in secondary school, between the age of 10 until the age of 14 years old. So every single lunch, I was walking from school to her place, then walking back. And I would have lunch with her, and she would always make every single effort to have a wonderful lunch for me to be refilled for school.
This is my mum, She's talking about her grandmother, my great grandmother, Mammy.
I have tons of memories with Mammy, with your great grandmother. There is not one single day and night where I sleep and I don't think of her. She was very, very important in my life.
I was 4 or 5 years old when Mammy started changing.
The beginning, she would obviously recognize us, but I think very quickly she would not recognize me anymore. So she would smile, but a little bit like automatic, you know, as automated mode. She would not really be able to speak.
My mom is trying to help me understand who exactly was behind that door I remember from my childhood. I always knew it was Mammy, but I didn't know Mammy. What I did know was the fear I felt as a child, and the sense of loss we felt as a family. For weeks now, I've been on this journey trying to figure out who was my great-grandmother. It all started off with this podcast assignment. My professor asked us to find a news story from 10 years ago and explore what has happened to a person in that story since the original news coverage. And of course, me being me, I had left this to the last minute and was rushing to finish this assignment. After hours of researching countless articles, I finally came across a story from 2013 that caught my eye. It was about art therapy helping people with Alzheimer's. It got me thinking back to my family's experience with a form of Alzheimer's. I thought, wow, this is it. This is my story. Right away, I contacted the art therapist quoted in the story, Kirsten Kamratine, via LinkedIn. I never expected that diving into that story and learning about her work would lead me closer to my own family.
My name's Kirsten Kamratine, and I'm a social worker and art therapist, and I currently work at the Alzheimer's Society Grey Bruce.
10 years ago, Kirsten was working in child welfare, while also pursuing a project using art therapy to treat patients with dementia. She introduced them to painting and drawing, sculpting and collage making, different forms of expression for people who struggle to express themselves using words. The project was called Fostering Personhood Through Creative Expression. Kirsten got the opportunity to present it at the Alzheimer's Disease International Conference in Puerto Rico that year. And it was well received.
There was that recognition that, hey, we need to start to do something for people living with dementia, and they need activities like everyone else.
Now Kirsten works full-time with Alzheimer's patients.
I continue to do art therapy, and we have a program through the Alzheimer's Society Grey Bruce called Active Living. And that's a social recreation program for people to engage in meaningful activities. Every 8 weeks, I provide a session as a part of my work. So I use this special method called Time Slips, which was developed by a woman named Anne Basting. And it's where you have like a funny staged photograph and you use that, and I still use it to this day in my art therapy sessions. You use that as the way to start to engage people. What do you want to say about this picture? What's happening in this picture? There's no right or wrong answers. So it allows this opening up, this gateway where people can just have fun and open up. There's no wrong answers. So it takes the pressure off of, you know, having the right word. And so that was my thought process. I wanted to show that people living with this disease can participate in community, and it's super important that we treat people with dignity. And this was a way to showcase that, hey, I'm still here, and these are the parts that are here.
So my family could have reached out to these parts in Mammy, these parts that were still there, just waiting to be addressed?
Using art is a way to tap into parts of us that we can't access otherwise. We don't store trauma in a verbal part of the brain. we store it in a very nonverbal part of the brain. And sometimes the only way to access parts of yourself and parts of your experience in order to heal is through a visual way, a tactile way. I just was amazed at all the different uses of art therapy with different populations. So it's very flexible and adaptable.
Kirsten's project involved also having the art displayed in a gallery. That was a special moment for the people with dementia who created the art, and for their families too.
Kirsten, thank you so much for your time. It's been a wonderful interview. And
by the end of my interview, I couldn't stop thinking about how her work might have affected my family had we known about it in time. I told Kirsten a bit about my family member who died when I was very young.
And I would have loved for, you know, maybe for her to have tried this form of healing.
Absolutely. What was her name, Matisse?
Well, we called her Mami.
I found myself reminiscing about the memories of my great-grandmother, Mami, someone whom I have vivid recollections of, but I never really got to know. I kept wondering, what if Mami could have benefited from art therapy? Would anything have been different then? This research started as just an assignment, but now it's become my mission to discover more about my great-grandmother. When we lost her, I was too young to fully grasp her experience and who she was. So I reached out to her son, my granddad. He dedicated his life to caring for Mami when she was ill. He's also the doctor in our family. He's 85 and lives in Paris. I'm an exchange student away at school in Toronto. So I talked him through the setup for our recording over Zoom.
Tiens-le près de... Enfin, t'es pas obligé de le tiendre tout près de ton...
Oui, comme ça.
Ouais, c'est parfait. Donc voilà, d'abord, tu vas bien?
Oui, mais c'est la même question.
Now, something has always puzzled me. I could never obtain an explicit answer from my mum about Mami's clinical diagnosis. Mum always told me Mami had a form of Alzheimer's, but I never knew what she meant by this. So I asked my granddad.
Dans le diagnostic de la maladie d'Alzheimer, il y a beaucoup d'hésitations. Il n'y a pas de marqueur précis de la maladie. Curieusement, il y a eu dans la phase terminale, elle a perdu la capacité d'avaler.
In the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, there is no precise marker of the disease. In the final phase of mother's case, she lost the ability to swallow and therefore had difficulties feeding herself. This is not very common in Alzheimer's disease. So at this age, it's possible for people to have Alzheimer's disease that's aggravated by vascular disorders. So a precise diagnosis is extremely difficult.
Donc un diagnostic précis est extrêmement difficile.
My granddad explained that at first, Mami was able to walk and run errands like groceries.
Au tout début de la maladie, maman était capable de marcher, d'aller au Monoprix et d'acheter des choses. Le premier signe de sa maladie a été de se perdre, c'est-à-dire qu'elle n'a pas su revenir immédiatement du Monoprix.
The first sign of her illness was to get lost. She didn't know how to return immediately from the supermarket. She could no longer recognize me. She confused me with my father, and she called me Garo.
Elle m'appelait Garo.
I remember my mom telling me this when I spoke to her. Mami would slowly forget who we were. She confused her son with her husband, Garo. This was something that I never noticed myself, but as I grew older, my family would explain to me. My granddad told me that at noon, he would go have lunch in Mami's room, the room at the end of the corridor. And so he sat at the table. He tried to talk to her, but at that moment, he said there was practically no communication. Yet he still tells me that he would talk with her and kiss her. I asked him, what kind of things would you tell Mami? How would she react?
Comment elle réagirait?
Elle réagit pas.
She doesn't react? I was confused.
Non, parce qu'elle, à l'extrême, elle ne comprend peut-être même pas ce que tu lui dis.
No, because at the peak of her illness, she doesn't even understand what you were saying to her.
He says she was very passive, never aggressive, except sometimes if you touched her. Or if you tried to move the sheets that were covering her, there would immediately be a movement of defense. That might explain the screams I heard from her when I was little. Or was that just her trying to say something?
Then her expression were more sounds or little shouts. There is a part of your brain which is controlling your emotions, and this ability to filter your emotion, filter your anxiety or your anger, or is disappearing. So she could start, biting or doing things which are very weird, because she was losing her cells that were enabling her to control her behaviors.
That's my mom's perspective. And it makes sense to me. Although, what's interesting is how both my mum and granddad seem to recall interacting with Mami, despite saying there practically was no communication.
Like, she could listen and she would respond, even if it was not completely adequate. I would stand next to her bed, I would hold her hands, we would sort of discuss. She had an aide, a nurse, so we would discuss, the three of us. But I think what was becoming more difficult was when the dialogue was stopped because she was not in capacity of responding, then it was just looking at her, hoping that she was not in pain, trying to think what she had in her mind. So I was probably talking and telling her what happened and talking about you guys, what you are doing, not expecting any answers, but try to be part of her world in a way. And for whatever she was getting from what I was saying, hoping that she could still be a little bit part of our world. And then that was, when she was still at your granddad place, but there was a time where this was no longer possible.
Dans l'EHPAD où elle était.
In the house where she was, we had chosen, as a precaution, a room with two beds. So she was not alone in the room. She had a roommate who was fully conscious, who didn't have the same illness.
Qui n'avait pas du tout la même maladie.
He told me she wasn't really aware of her roommate.
Mais la voisine, à chaque fois que je passais la voir maman, elle me disait, elle a passé une bonne nuit. Y a pas eu de problème, monsieur. L'infirmière est passée.
But every time I went to see mother, the roommate would tell me, she had a good night. There was no problem, sir. The nurse came by, or the person who gives her food came by. So, I would knock on the door of the room for the roommate, not for mother. She would never notice. I even made an attempt to put some Armenian music on my phone and pass the music to her ear. She probably heard it, but she never reacted.
Kirsten says, through art, it's possible to regain a sense of control, as it allows us to tap into parts of us that we can't access otherwise. I want to know. I need to know. Would Mami have benefited from using art therapy as a form of healing?
Je suis pas persuadé qu'on puisse réveiller des choses.
I'm not convinced that you can stimulate these things at such a late stage of the disease.
Essentially, what my granddad was telling me is that the effectiveness of using art therapy as a treatment is somewhat dependent on what stage of Alzheimer's we're talking about. Mami's disease appeared when she was about 88 years old. Kirsten's project only involved patients in the early to mid stages of dementia.
Mais tu vois, ça me fait penser, maman, elle aimait la musique, elle avait le rythme, elle adorait danser.
See, it makes me think. Mom loved to dance. She loved music. She loved rhythm. She loved to dance. The fact that she didn't react at all when music was played. I don't see how her memory could have been refreshed. But it's possible.
I asked my granddad, almost reluctantly, if there was anything that he wished he could have done differently when it came to providing the best care for Mamie.
Well, je suis heureux de l'avoir gardée aussi longtemps que ça.
I'm happy that I kept her living at home for as long as possible. She had the affection of her entourage, the details of her living space. It didn't mean anything for her, but I kept her at home. She had her bed, and so I don't think so. There was no other way.
Il y avait pas d'autres moyens. D'ailleurs, je suis pas certain.
I do believe this answer is genuine. My granddad did everything he could to take the best care of his mother. And he says he recognizes the importance today of trying out all kinds of therapies to spark some form of creative expression. I then asked him, what memory of his mother will stay with him for the rest of his life?
Que tu retiendras toujours de mamie une leçon ou un souvenir, qu'est-ce que ça serait?
Je dirais, pour la caractériser, c'est le jour où je suis arrivé à la maison en disant j'ai eu un 18 en mathématiques, elle m'a dit pourquoi pas 20. Mais c'était de l'affection. C'est pas de la sévérité.
If I was to characterize her, I'll say, the day I came home from school saying, I got 18 out of 20 on a math test, and she said, why not 20? But it was all out of affection. It wasn't severity.
This was extremely hard to hear, especially sitting 7,000 kilometers away. I just wanted to put my arm around him and just comfort him with a nice warm hug.
After joining me on this journey and listening to all of this, my co-producers Far and Daisy wanted to know what memories I would use to characterize Mamie.
Well, it's not a direct memory, at least for me, but, you know, kind of what I've said about the one picture I've seen of her when she's on her two feet, we're outside, and she's pushing me in my stroller. I've heard that story over and over again from my parents, from my grandparents. This journey started off with my interest in Kirsten's work. But through adventuring to the past, talking to my mum, to my grandfather, I learned more about who my great-grandmother was. She wasn't just a woman with dementia. She had a whole life outside that room that was filled with personality, love, and many memories. Goes to show that, yeah, her life was not, she is remembered not from, you know, being in that room the entire time. She led a whole life before that. Yeah, she's just a truly remarkable woman and this powerful figure in our lives. And not everyone gets the happiest of endings sometimes. And it's just like, you know, it's not exactly a fairy tale ending, and that's okay because there's a whole story behind it. There's a whole other narrative behind her life that should be emphasized because that's the majority of that time period defines her, defines who she was, not the unfortunate ending.
I learned many things about my great-grandmother when producing this story. But I also think this experience changed my outlook on life.
It made me more mature, more accepting, and know that not everyone is fortunate, but our endings are not the sum of who we are. There are always more roots to us that should be acknowledged.
We Met Xu Wen is a production by journalism students from the Creative School at Toronto Metropolitan University. This episode was produced by Daisy Kim, Far Azizullah, and me, Matisse Sheikh. Mixing and sound design by Mia Johnson. Shari Okeke is our executive producer and professor. Angela Glover is our director of audio production. Our season 2 graphic was created by Mana Hosseini. Web design by Daniela Olariu. Special thanks to Juleika Lantigua, founder of LWC Studios, for her support during our pitching process. And thank you to the Creative School for the Curriculum Innovation Grant that made Juleika's participation possible. Thanks also to Professor Bill Reynolds for voicing translation of my granddad. I'm Matisse Sheik. Thanks for listening.